I am afraid I could not get hold of him now, said our companion, and lapsed into a preoccupied silence from which all Taverner's conversational efforts failed to rouse him. We had evidently struck some painful subject, and I saw my colleague make a mental note of the fact. As soon as we got in, Taverner went straight to his study, opened the safe, and took out a card index file. Maffeo, Montague, Mortimer, he muttered, as he turned the cards over. Anthony William Mortimer, initiated into the Order of the Cowled Brethren, October, 1912, took office as armed guard, May, 1915. Arrested on suspicion of espionage, March, 1916. Prosecuted for exerting undue influence in the making of his mother's will. Everybody seems to go for him, and no one seems to be able to catch him. Became Grand Master of the Lodge of Set the Destroyer. Knox, 232, password, Jackal. So much for Mr. Mortimer. A good man to steer clear of, I should imagine. Now I wonder what Martin has done to upset him. As we dared not question Martin, we observed him, and I very soon noticed that he watched the incoming posts with the greatest anxiety. He was always hanging about the hail when they arrived, and seized his scanty mail with eagerness, only to lapse immediately into despondency. Whatever letter it was that he was looking for never came. He did not express any surprise at this, however, and I concluded that he was rather hoping against hope than expecting something that might happen. Then one day he could stand it no longer, and as for the 20th time I unlocked the mailbag and informed him that there was nothing for him, he blurted out, "Do you believe that absence makes the heart grow fonder, Dr. Rhodes?" "It depends on the nature," I said. "But I have usually observed if you have fallen out with someone, you are more ready to overlook his shortcomings when you have been away from him for a time. But if you are fond of someone?" He continued, half anxiously, half shamefacedly. "It is my belief that love cools if it is not fed," I said. "The human mind has great powers of adaptation, and one gets used, sooner or later, to being without one's nearest and dearest." "I think so, too," said Martin, and I saw him go off to seek consolation from his pipe in a lonely corner. "So there is a woman in the case," said Taverner when I reported the incident. "I should rather like to have a look at her. I think I shall set up as a rival to Mortimer, if he sends black thought forms. Let me see what I can do with their white one." I guessed that Taverner meant to make use of the method of silent suggestion, of which he was a past master. Apparently Taverner's magic was not long in working, for a couple of days later I handed Martin a letter which caused his face to light up with pleasure, and sent him off to his room to read it in private. Half an hour later he came to me in the office and said, "Dr. Rhodes, would it be convenient if I had a couple of guests to lunch tomorrow?" I assured him that this would be the case, and noted the change wrought in his appearance by the arrival of the long-wished-for letter. He would have faced a pack of black dogs at that moment. Next day I caught sight of Martin showing two ladies round the grounds, and when they came into the dining room he introduced them as Mrs. and Miss Hallam. There seemed to be something wrong with the girl, I thought, she was so curiously distrait and absent-minded. Martin, however, was in the seventh heaven. The man's transparent pleasure was almost amusing to witness. I was watching the little comedy with a covert smile, when suddenly it changed to tragedy. As the girl stripped her gloves off, she revealed a ring upon the third finger of her left hand. It was undoubtedly an engagement ring. I raised my eyes to Martin's face, and saw that his were fixed upon it. In the space of a few seconds the man crumpled, the happy little luncheon party was over. He strove to play his part as host, but the effort was pitiful to watch, and I was thankful when the close of the meal permitted me to withdraw. I was not allowed to escape, however. Taverner caught my arm as I was leaving the room and drew me out on the terrace. "Come along," he said. "I want to make friends with the Hallam family, they may be able to throw some light on our problem." We found that Martin had paired off with the mother, so we had no difficulty in strolling round the garden with the girl between us. She seemed to welcome the arrangement, and we had not been together many minutes before the reason was made evident. "Dr. Taverner," she said, "may I talk to you about myself?"
"I shall be delighted, Miss Hallam," he replied.
"What is it you want to ask me about?"
"I am so very puzzled about something."
"Is it possible to be in love with a person you don't like?"
"Quite possible," said Taverner, "but not likely to be very satisfactory."
"I am engaged to a man," she said, sliding her engagement ring on and off her finger, "whom I am madly, desperately in love with when he is not there, and as soon as he is present I feel a sense of horror and repulsion for him. When I am away, I long to be with him, and when I am with him, I feel as if everything were wrong and horrible. I cannot make myself clear, but do you grasp what I mean?"
"How did you come to get engaged to him?"
asked Taverner. "In the ordinary way. I have known him nearly as long as I have Billy," indicating Martin, who was just ahead of us, walking with the mother.
"No undue influence was used?" said Taverner.
"No, I don't think so. He just asked me to marry him, and I said I would."
"How long before that had you known that you would accept him if he proposed to you?"
"I don't know. I hadn't thought of it. In fact, the engagement was as much a surprise to me as to everyone else. I had never thought of him in that way till about 3 weeks ago, and then I suddenly realized that he was the man I wanted to marry. It was a sudden impulse, but so strong and clear that I knew it was the thing for me to do."
"And you do not regret it?"
"I did not until today. But as I was sitting in the dining room, I suddenly felt how thankful I should be if I had not got to go back to Tony." Taverner looked at me.
"The psychic isolation of this house has its uses," he said.
Then he turned to the girl again.
"You don't suppose that it was Mr. Mortimer's forceful personality that influenced your decision?"
I was secretly amused at Taverner's shot in the dark, and the way the girl walked blissfully into his trap.
"Oh, no," she said. "I often get those impulses. It was on just such a one that I came down here."
"Then," said Taverner, "it may well be on just such another that you got engaged to Mortimer, so I may as well tell you that it was I who was responsible for that impulse." The girl stared at him in amazement.
"As soon as I knew of your existence, I wanted to see you. There is a soul over there that is in my care at present, and I think you play a part in his welfare."
"I know I do," said the girl, gazing at the broad shoulders of the unconscious Martin with so much wistfulness and yearning that she clearly betrayed where her real feelings lay.
"Some people send telegrams when they wish to communicate, but I don't. I send thoughts, because I am certain they will be obeyed. A person may disregard a telegram, but he will act on a thought, because he believes it to be his own, though, of course, it is necessary that he should not suspect he is receiving suggestion, or he would probably turn round and do the exact opposite."
Miss Hallam stared at him in astonishment.
"Is such a thing possible?"
she exclaimed. "I can hardly believe it. You see that vase of scarlet geraniums to the left of the path? I will make your mother turn aside and pick one. Now watch." We both gazed at the unconscious woman as Taverner concentrated his attention upon her. And sure enough, as they drew abreast of the vase, she turned aside and picked a scarlet blossom.
"What are you doing to our geraniums?"
Taverner called to her.
"I am so sorry," she called back. "I am afraid I yielded to a sudden impulse."
"All thoughts are not generated within the mind that thinks them," said Taverner. "We are constantly giving each other unconscious suggestions, and influencing minds without knowing it, and if a man who understands the power of thought deliberately trains his mind in its use, there are few things he cannot do." We had regained the terrace in the course of our walk, and Taverner took his farewell and retired to the office. I followed him, and found him with the safe open and his card index upon the table.
"Well, Rhodes, what do you make of it all?" he greeted me.
"Martin and Mortimer after the same girl," said I.
"And Mortimer uses for his private ends the same methods you use on your patients."
"Precisely," said Taverner, "an excellent object lesson in the ways of black and white occultism. We both study the human mind, we both study the hidden forces of nature. I use my knowledge for healing and Mortimer uses his for destruction."
Tavernor, I said, facing him, what is to prevent you also from using your great knowledge for personal ends? Several things, my friend, he replied. In the first place, those who are taught as I am taught are, though I say it who shouldn't, picked men, carefully tested. Secondly, I am a member of an organization which would assuredly exact retribution for the abuse of its training, and, thirdly, knowing what I do, I dare not abuse the powers that have been entrusted to me. There is no such thing as a straight line in the universe, everything works in curves, therefore it is only a matter of time before that which you send out from your mind returns to it. Sooner or later Martin's dog will come home to its master. Martin was absent from the evening meal, and Taverner immediately inquired his whereabouts. He walked over with his friends to the crossroads to put them on the bus for Haslemere, someone volunteered, and Tavernor, who did not seem too well satisfied, looked at his watch. It will be light for a couple of hours yet, he said. If he is not in by dusk, Rhodes, let me know. It was a grey evening, threatening storm, and darkness set in early. Soon after 8 I sought Tavernor in his study and said, Martin isn't in yet, Doctor. Then we had better go and look for him, said my colleague. We went out by the window to avoid observation on the part of our other patients, and, making our way through the shrubberies, were soon out upon the moor. I wish we knew which way he would come, said Tavernor. There is a profusion of paths to choose from. We had better get on to high ground and watch for him with the field glasses. We made our way to a bluff topped with wind-torn Scotch firs, and Tavernor swept the heather paths with his binoculars. A mile away he picked out a figure moving in our direction, but it was too far off for identification. Probably Martin, said my companion, but we can't be sure yet. We had better stop up here and await events. If we drop down into the hollow we shall lose sight of him. You take the glasses, your eyes are better than mine. How infernally early it is getting dark tonight. We ought to have had another half hour of daylight. A cold wind had sprung up, making us shiver in our thin clothes, for we were both in evening dress and hatless. Heavy grey clouds were banking up in the west, and the trees moaned uneasily. The man out on the moor was moving at a good pace, looking neither to right nor left. Except for his solitary figure the great grey waste was empty. All of a sudden the swinging stride was interrupted, he looked over his shoulder, paused, and then quickened his pace. Then he looked over his shoulder again and broke into a half trot. After a few yards of this he dropped to a walk again, and held steadily on his way, refusing to turn his head. I handed the glasses to Tavernor. It's Martin right enough, he said, and he has seen the dog. We could make out now the path he was following, and, descending from the hill, set out at a rapid pace to meet him. We had gone about a quarter of a mile when a sound arose in the darkness ahead of us, the piercing, inarticulate shriek of a creature being hunted to death. Tavernor let out such a halloo as I did not think human lungs were capable of. We tore along the path to the crest of a rise, and as we raced down the opposite slope, we made out a figure struggling across the heather. Our white shirt fronts showed up plainly in the gathering dusk, and he headed towards us. It was Martin running for his life from the death hound. I rapidly outdistanced Tavernor, and caught the hunted man in my arms as we literally cannoned into each other in the narrow path. I could feel the played-out heart knocking like a badly running engine against his side. I laid him flat on the ground, and Tavernor coming up with his pocket medicine case, we did what we could. We were only just in time. A few more yards and the man would have dropped. As I straightened my back and looked round into the darkness, I thanked God that I had not that horrible power of vision which would have enabled me to see what it was that had slunk off over the heather at our approach. That something went I had no doubt, for half a dozen sheep, grazing a few hundred yards away, scattered to give it passage. We got Martin back to the house and sat up with him. It was touch and go with that ill-used heart, and we had to drug the racked nerves into oblivion. Shortly after midnight Tavernor went to the window and looked out. Come here, Rhodes, he said. Do you see anything? I declared that I did not. It would be a very good thing for you if you did, declared Taverner. You are much too fond of treating the thought forms that a sick mind breeds as if, because they have no objective existence, they were innocuous. Now come along and see things from the viewpoint of the patient. He commenced to beat a tattoo upon my forehead, using a peculiar syncopated rhythm. In a few moments I became conscious of a feeling as if a suppressed sneeze were working its way from my nose up into my skull. Then I noticed a faint luminosity appear in the darkness without, and I saw that a greyish-white film extended outside the window. Beyond that I saw the death hound, a shadowy form gathered itself out of the darkness, took a run towards the window, and leapt up, only to drive its head against the grey film and fall back. Again it gathered itself together, and again it leapt, only to fall back baffled. A soundless baying seemed to come from the open jaws, and in the eyes gleamed a light that was not of this world. It was not the green luminosity of an animal, but a purplish grey reflected from some cold planet beyond the range of our senses. That is what Martin sees nightly, said Taverner, only in his case the thing is actually in the room. Shall I open a way through the psychic bell jar it is hitting its nose against, and let it in? I shook my head and turned away from that nightmare vision. Taverner passed his hand rapidly across my forehead with a peculiar snatching movement. You are spared a good deal, he said, but never forget that the delusions of a lunatic are just as real to him as that hound was to you. We were working in the office next afternoon when I was summoned to interview a lady who was waiting in the hall. It was Miss Hallam, and I wondered what had brought her back so quickly. The butler tells me that Mr. Martin is ill and I cannot see him, but I wonder if Dr. Taverner could spare me a few minutes. I took her into the office, where my colleague expressed no surprise at her appearance. So you have sent back the ring? He observed. Yes, she said. How do you know? What magic are you working this time? No magic, my dear Miss Hallam, only common sense. Something has frightened you. People are not often frightened to any great extent in ordinary civilized society, so I conclude that something extraordinary must have happened. I know you to be connected with a dangerous man, so I look in his direction. What are you likely to have done that could have roused his enmity? You have just been down here, away from his influence, and in the company of the man you used to care for, possibly you have undergone a revulsion of feeling. I want to find out, so I express my guess as a statement. You, thinking I know everything, make no attempt at denial, and therefore furnish me with the information I want. But, Dr. Taverner, said the bewildered girl, why do you trouble to do all this when I would have answered your question if you had asked me? Because I want you to see for yourself the way in which it is possible to handle an unsuspecting person, said he. Now tell me what brought you here. When I got back last night, I knew I could not marry Tony Mortimer, she said, and in the morning I wrote to him and told him so. He came straight round to the house and asked to see me. I refused, for I knew that if I saw him I should be right back in his power again. He then sent up a message to say that he would not leave until he had spoken to me, and I got in a panic. I was afraid he would force his way upstairs, so I slipped out of the back door and took the train down here, for somehow I felt that you understood what was being done to me, and would be able to help. Of course, I know that he cannot put a pistol to my head and force me to marry him, but he has so much influence over me that I am afraid he may make me do it in spite of myself. I think, said Taverner, that we shall have to deal drastically with Master Anthony Mortimer. Taverner took her upstairs, and allowed her and Martin to look at each other for exactly 1 minute without speaking, and then handed her over to the care of the matron. Towards the end of dinner that evening I was told that a gentleman desired to see the secretary, and went out to the hall to discover who our visitor might be. A tall, dark man with very peculiar eyes greeted me. I have called for Miss Hallam, he said. Miss Hallam? I repeated as if mystified. Why, yes, he said, somewhat taken aback, isn't she here? I will inquire of the matron, I answered. I slipped back into the dining room, and whispered to Taverner, Mortimer is here. He raised his eyebrows. I will see him in the office, he said. Thither we repaired, but before admitting our visitor, Taverner arranged the reading lamp on his desk in such a way that his own features were in deep shadow and practically invisible. Then Mortimer was shown in. He assumed an authoritative manner. I have come on behalf of her mother to fetch Miss Hallam home, said he. I should be glad if you would inform her I am here. Miss Hallam will not be returning tonight, and has wired her mother to that effect. I did not ask you what Miss Hallam's plans were, I asked you to let her know I was here and wished to see her. I presume you are not going to offer any objection? But I am, said Taverner. I object strongly. Has Miss Hallam refused to see me? I have not inquired. Then by what right do you take up this outrageous position? By this right, said Taverner, and made a peculiar sign with his left hand. On the forefinger was a ring of most unusual workmanship that I had never seen before. Mortimer jumped as if Taverner had put a pistol to his head. He leant across the desk and tried to distinguish the shadowed features. Then his gaze fell upon the ring. The senior of seven, he gasped, and dropped back a pace. Then he turned and slunk towards the door, flinging over his shoulder such a glance of hate and fear as I had never seen before. I swear he bared his teeth and snarled. Brother Mortimer, said Taverner, the dog returns to its kennel tonight. Let us go to one of the upstairs windows and see that he really takes himself off, went on Taverner. From our vantage point we could see our late visitor making his way along the sandy road that led to Thursley. To my surprise, however, instead of keeping straight on, he turned and looked back. Is he going to return? I said in surprise. I don't think so, said Taverner. Now watch, something is going to happen. Again Mortimer stopped and looked around, as if in surprise. Then he began to fight. Whatever it was that attacked him evidently leapt up, for he beat it away from his chest. Then it circled round him, for he turned slowly so as to face it. Yard by yard he worked his way down the road, and was swallowed up in the gathering dusk. The hound is following its master home, said Taverner. We heard next morning that the body of a strange man had been found near Branshott. It was thought he had died of heart failure, for there were no marks of violence on his body. 6 miles, said Taverner. He ran well. End of this story, and next is a daughter of Pan. Taverner looked at a card that had been brought to him. Rhodes, he said. If the county take to calling, I shall put up the shutters and write Ichabod upon them, for I shall know that the glory is departed. Now what in the name of Beelzebub, Asmodeus, and a few other of my friends to whom you have not been introduced, does this woman want with me? Taverner, his methods and his nursing home, were looked upon askance by the local gentry, and as he, for his part, did not care to prescribe for measles and influenza, we seldom came into contact with our neighbors. That my colleague was a man of profound learning and cosmopolitan polish would have availed him nothing at the local tea parties, which judge a man by his capacity to avoid giving offense. A narrow-hipped, thin-lipped woman was ushered into the room. The orderly waves of her golden hair and the perfection of her porcelain complexion bore evidence to the excellence of her maid and the care that was devoted to her toilette. Her clothes had that upholstered effect which is only obtained when the woman is made to fit the garment, not the garment the woman. I want to consult you, she said, about my youngest daughter. She is a great source of anxiety to us. We fear her mind is not developing properly. What are her symptoms? Asked Taverner with his most professional manner. She was always a difficult child, said the mother. We had a great deal of trouble with her. So different to the others. Finally we stopped trying to bring her up with them, and got her special governesses and put her under medical supervision. Which I suppose included strict discipline, said Taverner. Of course, said our visitor. She has been most carefully looked after, we have left nothing undone, though it has been a great expense, and I must say that the measures we took have been successful up to a point. Her terrible outbreaks of wildness and temper have practically ceased. We have seen nothing of them for a year, but her development seems to have been arrested. I must see your daughter before I can give an opinion, said Taverner. She is out in the car, said her mother. I will have her brought in. She appeared in the care of her governess, who looked the excellent disciplinarian she was reported to be. As a Prussian drill sergeant of the old regime, she would have found her métier. The girl herself was a most curious study. She was extraordinarily like her mother. There was the same thin figure, though in the case of the mother the angularities had been padded out by art, whereas in the daughter they came glaringly through her garments, which looked as if she had slept in them. Lank, mouse-colored hair was wound round her head in heavy greasy coils, a muddy complexion, fish-like eyes, and general air of awkwardness and sprawling limbs completed the unpleasing picture. Huddled up on the sofa between the two women, who seemed to belong to another species, and who discussed her before her face as if she had been an inanimate object, the girl looked a typical low-grade defective. Now, defectives fill me with nothing but disgust. My pity I reserve for their families, but the girl before me did not inspire me with disgust, but only pity. She reminded me of a caged lark in some wretched animal dealer's shop, its feathers dull with dirt and frayed with the bars, apathetic, unhealthy, miserable, which will not sing because it cannot fly. What nature had intended her to be it was impossible to say, for she had been so thoroughly worked over by the two ardent disciplinarians who flanked her that nothing of the original material remained. Her personality displeased them, and they had effectually repressed it, but alas, there was nothing they could put in its place, and they were left with an unsealed automaton which they dragged off to alienist after alienist in the hopeless attempt to get the damage repaired while maintaining the conditions that had done the damage. I awoke from my abstraction to hear the mother, who evidently had a taste for economy where the ugly duckling was concerned, bargaining shrewdly with Taverner with regard to fees, and he, who was always more interested in the human than the commercial aspects of the work, was meeting her more than halfway. Taverner, I said as soon as the door closed behind them, what they are paying won't cover her board and keep, let alone treatment. They're not paupers, look at the car. Hang it all, why don't you make em fund up? My dear boy, said Taverner mildly, I have got to undercut the governess or I shouldn't get the job. Do you think the job is worth having at that price? I growled, for I hate to see a man like Taverner imposed upon. Hard to say, he replied. They have driven a square peg into a round hole with such determination that they have split the peg, but to what extent we cannot tell until we have got it out of the hole. But what are your impressions of our new patient? First impressions are generally the truest. What reaction does she awake in you? Those are the best indications in a psychological case. She seems to have given life up as a bad job, I replied. She's an unlovely object, and yet she is not repellent. I don't so much pity her as sympathize with her, there is a difference, you know. I can't put it clearer than that. You have put it very clearly indeed, said Taverner. The distinction between pity and sympathy is the touchstone in this case. We pity that which we ourselves are not, but we sympathize when, but for the grace of God, there goes you or I. You feel kinship for that soul because, whatever the husk of her may have been reduced to, she is one of us, marred in the making. And marred with a heavy hand, I added. I should think it would have been a case of the SPCC, if they had been poor people. You are wrong, said Taverner. It is a case for the SPCA, with which cryptic remark he left me. The next day the new patient, who answered to the inappropriate name of Diana, appeared. She looked about 15, but as a matter of fact was nearer 18. Gaunt, slovenly, ungainly, and morose, she had all the furtive ineptitude of a dog that has been ruined by harsh treatment. She was certainly not an addition to the social amenities of the place, and I should not have been surprised if Taverner had segregated her, but he did not seem disposed to, neither did he place her under any supervision, but gave her complete freedom. Unaccustomed to this lack of restraint, she did not seem to know how to employ herself, and slunk about as if at any moment outraged powers might exact retribution for some misdeed. There was a good deal of comment upon the way our new patient was neglected, and she was certainly not a credit to the establishment, but I began to see what Taverner was driving at. Left entirely to her own devices, the girl was beginning to find her level. If she wanted food, she had to prowl into the dining room somewhere about the time it was being served. When her hands became uncomfortably sticky, she washed them, as the towels bore evidence, for we could not always observe any difference in the hands.